Democrats cheered the passage of the Senate health care bill this past week, but not one Senate Republican voted for it. In the weekly Republican radio address, Congressman Duncan Hunter of California made it clear Republicans aren't happy about the direction Congress is taking.
So let's resolve in the new year to end misguided efforts to create new laws that will cost even more jobs, whether it's a cap and trade national energy tax, the government takeover of health care, card check, or even more tax increases. Working together, we can make the next holiday season even brighter for all Americans.
You could have watched that message on YouTube, which is becoming a very popular social media tool for Republicans these days. So are Facebook and Twitter, where Republicans are taking their message directly to the American people.
Hi, I'm Congressman Buck McKeon. Here I plan to share video footage of my work in Washington and at home in California. Thanks for visiting. Can you hear those buzzers? It means I'm being called to a vote, so I'm going to have to run. But I hope this page can be a resource for you.
Hi, I'm Eric Cantor. We've got a lot of cutting-edge things that we're putting in place. We want to engage the online community.
Hello, I'm Mitch McConnell, Republican leader of the United States Senate. For the past few years, I've found YouTube to be an extremely useful way of communicating with the American people.
We wanted to know how Republicans are using new forms of media and social networking and whether it's paying off. Republican strategist Mindy Finn helped Virginia Governor-elect Bob McDonnell find his voice online. Finn is a partner and blogger for the political consulting firm Engage.
Well, for Republicans who don't have any power necessarily in Congress right now, they're turning to social media in droves even faster than Democrats because it's a place where every individual can have a voice. Members who don't have a lot of say or don't have much of a voice in Congress can use social media to talk directly to their constituents, to voters, and to activists. Twitter especially in the early half of this year and continues to be dominated by conservatives. And they're finding that in a way that they haven't been able to even in other parts of the decade, they can become high touch again. It's high tech and high touch where constituents can hear directly from them. Through social media, they're creating a window, opening a door, providing a gateway to their work in Congress.
I've noticed that in job postings for congressional communications directors, they require the candidates to have new media experience. So you think this is indicative of a larger trend?
It's absolutely indicative of a larger trend. I've even heard chiefs of staff to members of Congress or the members themselves say, you know, my new media person is just as busy, if not more sometimes, than my traditional press person. And for a member of the House of Representatives particularly, it's very difficult for them to get a lot of press. But when it comes to new media, the opportunities are limitless for them to put out information. You know, in the past, they might put out a press release and nobody picks it up. But now, if they build up a network of blogger support, if they have a presence on Facebook or on Twitter, and they put out that same information, it can go virally across the internet.
Earlier this year, YouTube actually launched official congressional video channels for the House and the Senate. It appears that Republican members of Congress are uploading videos at a faster rate than Democrats. Can you explain why?
I think 2008 was a big wake-up call to Republican members of Congress. You know, not only was it obvious that Republicans were behind when it came to using new media and technology, but the voters were in an uprising. The polls showed that the American people just did not like the Republican Party. And so that provided an incentive to try a little bit harder, to try new ways to get the message out. Clearly, the old ways weren't working. And that incentive has now translated into members of Congress taking the time to sit down and produce a YouTube video, valuing that type of communication. And then especially when they see the results and they see the comments from people in their district who say, I saw you on YouTube. Thank you for appearing on a platform that is one that I use anyway for getting all types of information. The incentive has turned into action. And for someone like me, I can only be pleased by that type of activity.
Blogger and political consultant Mindy Finn. YouTube news and politics manager Olivia Ma has also been monitoring the rise in GOP presence on the site this past year. She says in 2009, 430 members of Congress signed up to use YouTube channels.
That's about 80% of Congress, which is just an enormous number. And the Republicans, it's been really interesting. They have been extremely eager since January. 89% of Republicans in Congress have now set up YouTube channels. And we're seeing that they're using it in a lot of different ways. Some are sort of more structured, formal programs. We've done a Senator of the Week program. YouTube will work with one senator and highlight them for the week. And we saw that Senator John Cornyn, the Republican senator from Texas, used that as an opportunity to engage the community in their thoughts on the stimulus package. And he invited users and citizens to react to it, you know, share their ideas for how the stimulus money should be used and talk about what it would mean for their community. And then he responded to the questions that were submitted and created a video, which he hosted on his channel.
Are there other examples?
Absolutely. I mean, that's an example of a sort of more formalized program on YouTube. But we're seeing the Republican whip, Congressman Eric Cantor, for example, when the healthcare debate was really kind of getting hot, that's been a big topic of discussion on YouTube this year. He created a mashup video where he took all of these different testimonials from Republican doctors and put it into a video. These were all sort of expressing why they disagreed with Obama's healthcare plan. And this, you know, this video did really well on YouTube.
YouTube's Olivia Ma. Republican strategists say it's imperative for politicians to create virtual relationships with their constituents. But Mindy Finn points out that House ethics rules aren't keeping up with the new ways politicians are using social media.
Right now, it is somewhat uncharted territory. In fact, I think that's one of the reasons that members have taken to it so kindly is that it is more open and it is more free. You know, there's some restrictions in that some members have two Facebook accounts. They have their official account. They have their campaign account. That can be confusing at times because it's one individual who seems to have two personas on the internet, which is a little bit artificial. But it will certainly be interesting to see how it evolves over time.
Mindy Finn of the political consulting firm Engage. We decided to check some Twitter feeds for members of Congress. This past Thursday, Senator David Vitter, Republican of Louisiana, tweeted, "Disappointed the Senate just passed Obamacare. I voted no. Battle is not over." You're listening to NPR News.
And our last word in business will be the last words we'll utter about Zuzu Pets, at least for this year.
Let's zoom, Zuzu Pets!
Zuzu Pets are zooming around, in and out through Whoa. Hamster Town. Now they have new clothes to wear, modern fashion flair. Hamsters going on vacation to an ocean destination, cruising to the sunny shore. And Zuzu Power Transportation.
Zuzu Pets are those furry robotic hamsters. You might have noticed they've been such hot sellers this year, stores have had to limit the number you can buy. Today's word is Zuzu Pets video game. The game maker Activision will come out with this new game next spring. Activision is the company behind this year's top-selling video game, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, a game where players get to engage in battle. The Zuzu Pets game will most likely be a whole lot less violent. That's because Activision will be targeting young girls, and let's face it, it features hamsters. And that's the business news on this Christmas morning for Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
So this is it. We've entered the last few days of what some call the aughts. And if you visited our website recently, you've seen some of our critics' picks for the best books, films, and music of the past 10 years. But there's one entirely new form of culture that came into its own over the past decade, the internet meme. They're basically nonsensical inside jokes that form on message boards and blogs and then spiral off into the wider internet. For instance, you might have been sent a link to see a video of, say, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's cats. And right in the middle of that video, the whole thing would change to this.
We're no strangers to love. You know the rules, and so do I.
That's the video for the 1987 song Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley. It's a classic online prank known as Rickrolling. Now, over the past few weeks and in the coming months, we're exploring some of the ideas that have made the Internet what it is today, 40 years since its creation. Our series is called The Net at 40, and joining us to talk about some of the prominent memes of the past decade is Kenyatta Cheese. He's the co-founder of the website KnowYourMeme.com. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The word meme is not a new word, right? I mean, internet meme is new, but where does the word meme come from?
So everyone's familiar with the term gene, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Richard Dawkins also came up with this term meme, which is basically a unit of cultural information that kind of just spreads on its own, or, you know, spreads through us and everything.
It's the British biologist Dawkins.
Yes. Mm. Internet memes is kind of like the illegitimate cousin of that stuff. Hmm. You know?
And when did internet memes really start to emerge?
Late 80s, early 90s, you know, you had people meeting on bulletin boards. You know, people would meet and kind of talk about stuff, and jokes would emerge that only made sense within the context of the bulletin board. The emoticon, that sideways smiley.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's kind of, you know, the first internet meme.
So let me first ask you about the Rickrolling. Where did this idea come from, and why Rick Astley?
It started off on a site called 4chan and quickly spread throughout the rest of the internet. It's funny because it's nonsense. It's unexpected.
And this actually became such a phenomenon that it got to the point where at the Macy's Day Parade in 2008, there was a float and it was puppets singing something. And then right in the middle of it, the real Rick Astley comes out of the float and starts singing his song. I mean, everyone apparently got the joke.
Well, I think half of America got the joke, and then the other half just kind of, you know, enjoyed the fact that it was Rick Astley, you know, appearing among a bunch of puppets.
It was so weird.
It was weird, but it was something where, because of the fact that you have so much of common culture happening online now, right, that's a place where traditional content kind of needs a look to find out what people are interested in, how to connect with them.
One of the most famous ones is this kid called the Star Wars Kid, and I guess someone posted this online without his permission, and it's become kind of like the best-known meme. What's the story behind that one?
Star Wars Kid was a 16-year-old named Gislan in Canada who recorded this video of himself using this golf ball retriever sort of as a weapon. But then there were people who actually went and took that original video and started applying these very sophisticated visual effects to it.
Right, like laser beams coming at him, or lasers.
Laser
coming
beams
at, yeah.
coming at him. You know, Yoda doing battle with him, putting him into the trailer for The Matrix.
What happened to the kid?
The kid kind of disappeared. He kind of went off the radar. But in the meantime, his family sued the parents of the kids who actually put the video up.
There are a couple of these memes that have been so enormously successful. I mean, in the sense that so many millions of people have seen them. I'm wondering if the people behind them have become famous. And, for example, there's one really famous one from a few years ago, I guess sort of known as the Numa Numa Dance. And there's this guy lip-syncing and dancing to this song.
Yeah, that's Gary Brosma. When he first posted the video, he actually put it up just for his friends. Well, his friends kind of took it, thought it was hilarious, passed it on to other people, and on and on and on, until the point of, you know, tens of thousands, and then hundreds of thousands, and then millions of forwards and views and everything. Gary ended up making appearances on TV shows. He was one of the first internet stars to kind of realize that this is something to be embraced.
Looking ahead now, do you expect internet memes to sort of fade out and kind of just go away?
Oh, God, no. Internet memes is a new space that kind of occupies a place that television can't, that newspapers can't, et cetera, where it requires people to go out and create the culture themselves. And honestly, I have a lot more fun creating culture and spreading it as opposed to just sitting back and watching TV.
That's Kenyatta Cheese. He's the co-founder of the website KnowYourMeme.com, and he joined me from NPR New York. Kenyatta Cheese, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are nearing the end of a year that's been, in electronic devices, the year of e-readers and smartphones and downsized laptop computers, also known as netbooks. So you may be wondering what the technology industry has in store for us in the new year. We asked our technology commentator Mario Armstrong to come by and make some predictions.
Well, I brought a few things in because these are things that are out and exist now. So what we have here are a couple of smartphones, the Motorola Droid, the iPhone, and Sony eBook Reader, a little netbook. These are existing products.
But these are things that you think are going to get bigger in the year to come.
Yeah. Number one, I think what we'll see is this rumored Apple tablet in 2010.
What do you mean by a tablet?
Well, for example, we've seen tablets before. I mean, Apple actually has a track record with this. But here's one that's a little bit older. It's an HP one that has a keyboard, and then you can actually write on it.
Oh, look at this. So I'm going to be writing on the screen using a stylus.
Stylus to write your information or notes or input information. Now, that's not really revolutionary. That's been around. However, it hasn't really taken off the way the industry thought it would. But then you start looking at things like ebook readers, like the Sony here, and that's taking off and doing phenomenally well. What I'm showing you here is I think there's a marriage that needs to be. We're looking at two totally separate devices, and people don't want to carry more devices. They want to carry less.
Yeah.
So we need a marriage. We need a go-between. We need a bridge, and I think the tablet's that bridge.
Can I just ask one question about the tablet? And people can't see this at home, but I just want to sign my name for you, Mario. Do you think that a computer is going to be able to read that? That's what I want to know.
Have you ever been a doctor? Because this is exactly what a prescription looks like.
I thought you were going to ask if I'd ever learned to write, actually. So that's what I want to know. If I've got this tablet and I got this stylus and I start scribbling, is the computer going to be able to decipher that?
So two things happen in a tablet scenario. Number one, it can capture your writing just as you do on that sheet of paper,
mm-hmm.
as an image.
Okay.
So it can capture that. Now, if you want it to translate what you're writing
so
into text.
So that other human beings could read it? Yes, yes, yes.
Then we have a different problem altogether.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know that software is going to fix your issue. You might have to go back to writing.
Okay, so we got that problem. Now, you've also got a couple of phones here. And, of course, the iPhone is already huge. What makes you think that this is a big deal for 2010? What's changing here?
That's a great point. And what's big about that is applications, Steve. This is what everyone's talking about. My specific prediction is location-based services.
Uh-huh.
You're carrying a cell phone with you,
yes.
and maybe you want to find those nearby restaurants.
Right.
Or, take it a step further, maybe you want to find other friends of yours that are also in an existing area so you two can meet up.
Okay.
But here's one that's interesting that's running on the Droid.
Okay.
It's called Shop Savvy.
All right.
And what you do with that one is you actually can use your phone as a barcode scanner. So the idea is you could actually go to a store.
And just wave the phone around?
Wave the phone at an item.
And it will tell me what it would cost to buy it somewhere else? Say?
That's exactly right. And
oh.
not online as well as geographically what other places may be near you that you could find that same item cheaper or less expensive.
Wow.
So mobile applications are really going to explode.
One other thing I want to ask about in 2010 is this. We're in the middle of some kind of change to healthcare regulations. Are people's basic medical experience is going to change because of technology in 2010.
Absolutely. We're going to start seeing more applications and also more devices that are consumer-focused so that you could be able to take readings or measurements or things at home and then send that via Bluetooth or through the internet to your physician or to your doctor.
So the doctor would say, don't bother to come in, just send me an email with attachments?
It might not even be an email. It might even be faster than that. It might be a wireless connection that sends them instant data as you're getting your readings.
And it's a program, they know what it is, so they have some confidence in the results, even though a nurse wasn't there shaking the thermometer.
Correct. I mean, that's what we hope to kind of see, that there is this confidence in this technology. I mean, certainly we're starting to see this already evolve. I mean, Google has a Google Health profile, so you can actually manage your online health records. Microsoft has something called the Health Vault. So this is already starting to show up where families are saying, you know, I have a parent in another city or state. I need to know all of their medications, all of their previous surgeries. So if something was to happen, I can forward that information to the doctor or to the hospital or to the emergency room.
Very clever of Microsoft to call it the Health Vault, because you know that one of the concerns that will be raised here is privacy.
Absolutely. That's going to be a major concern. How much information is too much? How many providers will ultimately be able to get their hands on this information? And this gets into that whole area of electronic medical records in consumer applications and consumer-driven devices.
Mario Armstrong is host of Digital Cafe on Baltimore Public Radio Station WYPR. Mario, thanks.
Thank you so much, Steve.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. These days, you can learn just about anything from a YouTube video.
First of all, I'm going to put this bow around his neck.
A South Carolina man teaches us how to tie a bow tie. His YouTube video has been viewed more than 650,000 times. Or maybe you've always wanted to learn how to play the piano.
Let's make this thing minor, shall we? We take the middle finger and move it down a half step to the F.
Today on All Tech Considered, we're going to talk with a man who is devoting his life to creating YouTube tutorials.
Welcome to the presentation on multiplying fractions. Today, you'll be very happy because you'll find out that this is one of the few times where multiplying something is easier than adding it. And if you don't believe me, let's do some problems.
That is Salman Khan, not the Salman Khan who's a Bollywood star. This is the Salman Khan, former hedge fund analyst turned online tutor. He has produced more than 1,000 YouTube videos ranging from basic multiplication of fractions to polynomial approximation of functions. And he joins us now from Silicon Valley in California. Welcome.
Thanks.
Your channel on YouTube is called the Khan Academy channel. Why did you decide to become a tutor online?
It happened fairly organically. I started remotely tutoring some of my cousins in New Orleans. I was working, as you mentioned, as a hedge fund analyst in Boston at the time. My cousin Nadia was having trouble placing into the pre-algebra class. So I talked to Nadia a little bit and I said, how about you and me do some remote tutoring after I come home from work and you come home from school? We'll get a conference call going and maybe we'll use Instant Messenger or we'll find something else. We ended up using Yahoo Doodle, and word got around amongst friends and family, and I had a little cohort of about 10 or 15 students. And then it just became difficult logistically between my work and their soccer practice. So, and I had to keep tutoring the same lessons over and over again, depending on how old they were. So I decided to just record my lessons, but in the same style that I was doing with Nadia that seemed to be effective. And I started just recording them and putting them on YouTube. And even your, my great-great-grandkids could learn from these same videos.
Now, I've watched a few of them. You never appear on screen, just a mouse arrow that draws in different colors on a black background, and you narrate. How are you actually making these?
When I started, it was literally I took Microsoft Paint, made the background black, picked some fluorescent colors, and I used this shareware, I think it was called Screen Video Recorder. It was a $20 piece of software to capture my screen and to record my voice at the same time, and that would just produce the videos. I just did it because that was, I thought, the cheapest and fastest way to make a decent quality video. Since then, one of the viewers actually donated a $300 piece of software called Camtasia Recorder for the screen capture, and now I use another piece of shareware called Smooth Draw 2, I think it's called. I use that to draw, and I just have a little Wacom graphic pen tablet to do the writing.
Now let's go through some of the range of what you are doing tutorials in mathematics and chemistry, biology.
Yeah, and this non-sciences, there's obviously a lot on finance and economics. Actually, a lot of that comes from last year during the financial crisis. In my hedge fund world, I put all my money in cash and I started reading the Federal Reserve Act. I read it about 10 times just to understand all of the levers that the Federal Reserve chairman could pull. And I said, well, what's a better use of my time than whatever I just learned? Let me make a series of YouTube videos on fractional reserve banking and the Federal Reserve. And I don't plan on limiting myself to just the maths and the sciences.
Now, here's something I noticed while watching a tutorial you were giving about stocks. You were, I think, making the point that a stock that costs $1 a share is not necessarily cheaper than a stock that costs $10 a share. As I'm watching it, a crawl comes across the bottom from Google directing me to a website where I can look over the prospectus for various penny stocks. It's an advertisement, and indeed the advertisement is actually based on a proposition that you're shooting down in the course of the tutorial. First of all, who's advertising? How many of your courses are advertised? And how do you feel about this kind of education being underwritten by a sponsor?
The advertising is what YouTube puts up just by virtue of it being on YouTube. I do share some of the revenue. It's pushing about $1,500 of revenue to Khan Academy, Inc., which is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. So it's going to the organization right now. It's not coming to me as a salary in any way right now.
Without the advertising, are you, I mean, I know you were working for a hedge fund before, but are you, is this self-sustaining? Can you support this as a career doing it based on people free of charge looking at videos?
Well, right now it isn't self-sustaining as of today. I joke that it's being funded by the Salman Khan Bank of America checking account. My wife has given me a year to make it self-sustaining, although I think she'll be giving me a little more leeway than that. If I get no outside support, there are the donations that are coming in from the viewers themselves. That's bringing in about $1,500 a month. I have these kind of low-key ads that you mentioned that are just off of YouTube. If I were to be aggressive with the advertising, which I don't want to do, I could probably generate another few thousand dollars a month. And at the rate that the viewership is growing, it's growing at about 15 or 20% per month. I'm reasonably confident that in about a year, the site itself could pay my rent and put food on the table.
Are you a faculty of one at the Khan Academy?
I currently am. There are people who have come out of the woodworks really in the last 2 months or so to volunteer translating the videos. There's a chemistry teacher in Uruguay who did the first translation. There's an effort going on to translate it into Arabic, into Polish, into Portuguese, into German. But right now, all of the content is and has been generated by me.
You come across in these videos as a very natural teacher. And I wonder, on the way through MIT and Harvard Business School and hedge fund trade, did you ever just consider becoming a teacher?
I actually was a teacher for just to make some extra cash during college. I was an MCAT instructor for the Princeton Review for one summer, and I used to volunteer teaching middle school kids at the Devotion School in Brookline. It's something that I really enjoy, but the economics of the hedge fund world were a little bit better.
You could have done a very simple tutorial on the difference between the pay of a hedge fund analyst and a teacher. When you're teaching online, there is not a real-time exchange with the students, and their comments to you aren't coming back in real time. Do you think that would be an added virtue of education? Or does it matter that much?
I think that this is an advantage I have over a traditional teacher. Just from my limited experience from teaching live, one of the hardest things is to sit in front of a classroom of 20 or 30 students, and maybe five of them are giving you a nice attentive expression, and the rest of them have blank faces. You don't know if they're bored or they're falling behind, and it makes you insecure, and you don't know what to do next. But I go to my computer, spend 10 minutes, explain something as I would explain it to you or my cousin, and then I upload it on YouTube. The whole process takes maybe half an hour, and within an hour of putting up a video, a few hundred people will watch it, and I wait for them to give that YouTube five-star rating and put a couple of comments up saying, oh, this is so great, I was going to fail this class, now I'm going to pass the exam tomorrow or whatever else. So I wait for that feedback, and that gives me the confidence to keep going.
Salman Khan, who teaches math, science, finance, and much more at Khan, K-H-A-N, academy.org. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
The cell phone has changed dramatically. Nowadays, it's not so much a phone as a way of life. You can use it to surf the web, check email, stream audio, video, take photos, use GPS. Those functions represent huge technological advances. But when Consumer Reports rated the best and worst of cell phones for its January 2010 issue, we noticed that for one category, not one of the phones achieved an excellent or even a very good. The category? Voice quality, which raises the question, why are such remarkable little devices so bad at being the basic thing that cell phones are, phones? Well, joining us is Michael Gikas, who is Senior Electronics Editor at Consumer Reports. And Michael Gikas, tell us about your findings.
Right. You said it yourself. Cell phones have come a long way in the last few years. They've added so many wonderful features. Web browsing, text messaging, social networking applications, they're mini computers. But one area where they haven't improved one bit is in voice quality.
Why is that? If you can listen to music on your cell phone, if you can record voice messages on your cell phone that all seem to have higher fidelity, why can't you hear someone decently when they call you?
Apparently, it's not high on the priority list of the carriers or the phone makers. Voice quality for them, if you can hear the other person at the other end, that's a success. So they end up with adequate service.
You have actually tested all the different cell phones in this category. Are there some that are remarkably better or remarkably worse than the others?
Well, generally speaking, phones that use CDMA technology, that's the phones that use the Verizon and Sprint network, tend to sound a little better than phones that are on AT&T's and T-Mobile's network. But that's not the whole story. There are lots of factors in here. It's not just the network. It could be the shape of the phone. For example, in the past, we've tested folding phones, flip phones, ones you open, and they seem to do a little better than the rectangular phones that you see now with touch screens. And the theory there is that the microphone and speaker are much closer to your mouth and ear.
So with the understanding that the best you get for listening quality on a cell phone is good, not right. Very good or excellent. What are some good cell phones for voice quality?
for AT&T. We recommend, if it's been around a while, the Moto Tundra, $180. These phones were very good for voice quality for talking and good for listening, which is about as good as you can get. From Sprint, the Instinct HD, it's $250. It's a little pricey, but there's also the Samsung Exclaim. For Verizon, we have the Samsung Alias 2 for $50 and the LG VX8360. That's a regular phone, a regular flip phone for only $40. Again, very good voice quality for talking, good for listening.
But the best of all of those models you've recommended, nobody did better than good for listening.
Nobody.
Nobody.
That's correct. And they're really steering voice callers to prepaid plans. That's where the simpler flip phones are, and that's where the more affordable plans are. It seems that the carriers are clearly focused on going for the feature phones because that's where the money is. I mean, if you want anything to do with the web, that's another $30 a month guaranteed. Keyboard, probably you want to do text messaging, another $20 a month for unlimited messaging. They don't get anything for voice quality, so as long as people aren't complaining, you know, as long as people can say, all right, it works. And you're seeing some plans now that are text only.
Well, Michael Gikas, Senior Electronics Editor at Consumer Reports, thanks for talking with us about your ratings of cell phones, particularly when it comes to voice quality.
Thank you, Robert.